episode of That's So Cincinnati. I am excited. I'm here with my co-host, Burl Love. Hi, Burl.
Hi, Sherry.
Weren't we just here?
We were just here, yeah.
Sometimes, you guys, when we record podcasts, they are like later in the week and then early in the week. So
we're getting this one out of the way early this week.
We are, but, you know, we thought
it's a Monday. We rarely record on a Monday. It's more like a Wednesday. But that's okay, because we have a lot to talk about.
We do.
You have a very exciting guest lined up.
It's been a long news year, I mean month so far. Our special guest today is new prosecutor, Connie Pillage.
5 or 6 days on the job?
Yes.
Not even a whole week.
Kind of, you know, we wrote a lot about this race kind of like in the days leading up to it, and then
it became a little bit more heated than I think a lot of people expected the prosecutor's race.
It did, because we were all busy paying attention to like Senate races and presidential races. But I think it was kind of cutting through at the end. And it ended up being with the county getting the first Democratic prosecutor in 92 years.
You did the math in 92 years. And just to bring everybody back up to speed, if you forgot, because November was so long ago, you had incumbent Melissa Powers, who wasn't elected. She was appointed after Joe Dieters left his post when he was appointed to the Ohio Supreme Court. But she had been in the prosecutor's office for a long time, part of the system. But it was an important race for Hamilton County because it was one of the last big roles held by a Republican in a county that has shifted blue. So,
and that means a lot of change is coming, even though on the campaign trail, she said that she wasn't going to say, okay, I'm clearing house and everybody's leaving and we're going to have like all new people. But it is kind of like a natural change period. And a lot of people have ended up leaving. There's about 30 vacancies. And so we are in very much change period, and we're going to ask her about that and what this looks like going forward.
All right. Well, that'll be a good conversation. Speaking of good conversations, we had a great conversation with the mayor last week, who, while we were recording the podcast, it was the second day or third day after the big snowfall, and he was going to rally the troops. He was dressed appropriately. He had his City of Cincinnati
boots
ball cap on.
Yeah.
No suit and tie. He had a, you know, very official looking City of Cincinnati ball cap on, some very sensible snow boots. And he had hinted that he was dealing with just the typical things a mayor deals with when people are waiting for their streets to be plowed. But as the week progressed, the city was still trying to catch up, and there was some criticism weighed against the response, even from within city council. So let's break that down a little bit.
You know, the city has, I have to say, we got more than 10 inches of snow that varies in different places in the city, depending on where you live, but more than 10 inches. It's the most snow that the region has seen since 2008, and certainly the most snow any single person in this administration has dealt with in their current roles of having to deal with snow. It just doesn't really snow here. We get 1 to 2 inches. It's hard to travel. They always have to deal with. We have small, old city, narrow streets. There's a lot to deal with.
And it also played into how long it took Cincinnati City Schools to reopen, because a lot of schools were in neighborhoods that they were behind on getting the, you know, the side streets and the residential streets cleared. So that played into it as well.
I'm going to say that it was a big fat mess. So
a big fat snowy
because
mess.
Because I have seen that, I refer to on this podcast every once in a while, that I have seen a lot. And so I have seen this before, and it didn't go smoothly from day one. And once the city seemed to be behind the ball on getting to the residential streets, it's almost like they never really caught up, and it did snowball. I have to say, I think that the mayor was hearing from citizens. I think he was hearing the schools. You know, it did depend on whether they were opening. Of course, we were throwing, you know, very cold mornings in to that mix. And I think he was also hearing from business leaders who were like, hey, guess what? I need all my workers to come back. Right. Christmas fell at a very weird time. And because the schools could not go back to school, people are like, I can't come into work because I got my kids at home. Also, I can't get out of my driveway. And so I think he was getting it from all the different areas.
And I mean, most cities, large cities, they can't budget and plan for a 20-year snow every year. It just doesn't make sense. So I think occasionally you can give a city the size of Cincinnati a little bit of slack to say, okay, typically they would have been on top of this. It's very hard to ramp up for that much snow. Other people, however, were like, this is an essential city service. If you can't keep the streets plowed in the winter, what does that say about all the other things that could happen? So I think I kind of took it as this, you know, for the AFTAB administration and Cheryl Long, the city manager, I think this did result in sort of like, okay, we need to assess some things here. We need to do better than this.
So that's actually a question that I do have. So everyone wrote about the criticism and everyone kind of lived it. So they know, like, it is time to be like, the question at hand now is, are they, and I'm going to be asking this, are they assessing things and going back? The city has an Office of Data Analytics and Performance. And what's for next time? Did they learn anything and would they change anything? And it really is about, you know, okay, was this a one-off or not? We won't know really till the next time. But what were the lessons learned? And so I think that's an important question to ask and not just be like, oh, it's just a flurry of criticism.
A flurry.
And see what I did there.
The situation's snowballing. You can't help yourself, Sherry.
And so anyway,
all right,
we'll see.
Well, if there's anyone that can ask these questions, it is you. So
do you want to know the most fun fact I learned about the snow, though?
What?
That the Cincinnati Bengals field the snow doesn't stick to it. Guess why?
Well, I know why.
I wrote a story about it. Thanks for reading, guys. You all do know, I feel like.
It was one of your biggest stories of the year so far. And this is not young New Year as far as how many people were interested and clicked on that story.
It's heated.
If you could have been in our newsroom the day we were all looking out the window at, you know, close to a foot of snow everywhere. Parking lots had barely been cleared, you know, Fort Washington Way, you could see the highway was cleared and everything like that. But just like magic before our eyes, the snow started to disappear on the playing surface of Paycor Stadium. And I was like, well, there certainly isn't a playoff game they're getting ready for, because at that point, you know, the Bengals were eliminated. But as you reported, Sherry, that sucker's heated.
It is. It, you know, not through the whole year, but in the case of a playoff game, it's heated through a certain amount of time. There's like coils inside of it.
Well, they turned that sucker on because that field was like clear within, you know, about 3 hours. There wasn't a speck of snow on it.
No. So we did. I did. That was my fun fact.
I need that for my driveway. Heated driveway.
Don't we all?
I know. All right.
Or where the dog goes out. I could use that for where the dog goes out.
I had to dig a nice path for the small dog because it was so deep he couldn't really get his leg in the air. Yeah. Oh, you know, the trials and tribulations of pet ownership. Mm-hmm. Anyway, well, should we bring in our special guest?
Absolutely.
All right.
Special guest time here on That's So Cincinnati. I'm excited to welcome, and I think this is the first time, other than the introduction, I'm saying this aloud to you. Welcome, Prosecutor Connie Pillich.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
What's it like being called prosecutor? That was a hard-fought race, and it is your title now.
Yeah, it's. I still am getting used to it. I think of it as I get to do a really, really cool job. The responsibility is enormous, of course, but I'm glad I get to do it, and it's been a fun first week.
Mother Nature eased you into it a little bit, is that right? You worked at home on the first day. It was very much a snow day in Cincinnati.
Yeah, my first decision as prosecutor was to close the office when the courthouse decided to close. If the courthouse is open, we're open. because our lawyers go to court.
Yeah, and it's an extraordinary for the courthouse to close decision because they don't want to do that because it puts everyone behind the eight ball and they nobody wants to be behind going into the week.
Yes, it's very rare.
So we've written a lot about the prosecutor's race. You were the Democratic candidate, the first, and now that you've won, the first Democratic prosecutor in 92 years. I did a ton of research to get to that number. A ton.
Thanks for doing that.
It gets convoluted like past, like earlier than the 1960s. And then you're like, oh no. But what made you decide to run for this very important job?
Well, you know, Sherry, I thought I was probably done running for office and was trying to figure out what I was going to do with the rest of my working years. But I did get a slew of phone calls asking me to look at it. And I was a little concerned because my husband has had some health issues that were pretty terrifying. And I was worried that they might recur. And in fact, I had to stop working for a little while just a few years ago because of one of those incidents. So I had to really think about it. And but I decided it was really important for me to run. I felt very strongly that we needed some big changes in that office and that some of that was based on your reporting, of course. And it was embarrassing to see the sloppy trial practices that were happening in there. So I decided it was very important to the community to bring some new blood into that office.
For those who follow along, Connie is talking about stories written by Dan Horn and Amber Hunt. They really did some big, deep dives last year into people who were unfairly prosecuted and really facing murder charges. And it was some very important reporting that they did. So I didn't want you to say, when you meant you, you meant the Inquirer. I'm very proud of my colleagues because that's important work to do and it takes a long time. If you guys saw the pile of folders, it was to the ceiling in a conference room of just hand paperwork to understand what was going on in those cases. And I appreciate you paying attention to that on the campaign trail. And I think voters were paying attention to that.
You had mentioned that reporting, and man, we're jumping right in. We're going to have to go back to the Connie Pilich origin story. We will go back to that. But since we're on the topic, some of the cases, you know, you mentioned earlier sloppy cases, but the, you know, prosecutors, investigators relying on, you know, criminal informants and cases kind of collapsing once they hit the court. Your predecessor's response to that was announcing the creation of a prosecution integrity unit. Can you talk a little bit about where that was before you took over and how you see that kind of... That function of the prosecutor's office moving forward?
Yeah, it doesn't exist. I've not found...
It never existed?
It may have, but it doesn't exist. It didn't exist when I took over.
Okay.
So it disappeared. The guy she put in charge of it, Rick Gibson, retired sometime last year, and it just doesn't exist. My opponent did call it a conviction integrity unit, and as you know, in the newspaper, in the Inquirer, you did document that it was nothing new in the prosecutor's office, which tells me that it's nothing. And also, she ignored all the best practices that have been researched and experimented with in different cities across the country for the last 15 years. And she went the opposite of that. So my response, you know, basically from my military background, I want to make sure that we do our own self-audit and look into the practices in our most serious cases. We couldn't possibly do it into every case, every criminal case that's filed. There's tens of thousands of those every year. So, but we'll go in and look at it on our own. We'll use it as a teachable tool. And I will be exploring a more thoughtful approach to a conviction integrity unit. But for me, we're starting it taking the initiative on our own to look at our own cases. That's going to be one of the harder projects I work on this year. It's probably going to take me quite a few months to get that going.
The auditing function of it.
Yeah.
What's the typical turnover when a new prosecutor comes in, especially when you have someone coming in from a different party?
It's been 92 years.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you I did look into what happened in Franklin County. They Democrats won that in 2020, am I correct there, for the first time. And my friends who are lawyers there said it was like rats jumping off a sinking ship. So they had a huge problem with personnel. We've had a number of people leave. I want to say, I just got a new report on it yesterday. I want to say it's less than 30. And then we'll have five people well, we had one retire at the end of the year. We'll have four people retiring this year as well. Sometime. Yeah, I met with all the potential retirees and promised them I would work with them to find a good departure date for them that suited their career needs and their pension needs.
What percentage of that, those 30 people, how big is the prosecutor's office?
200 people, but about 80 of them are our support staff, and about 120 are lawyers.
Okay.
And so the most of the support staff sticking around.
Okay.
And of those 80, I think 90 are civil servants. So they do not serve at the pleasure of the prosecutor. They have civil service protections.
Okay.
About 10 support staff, and all of the attorneys serve at the pleasure of the prosecuting attorney. And we had the biggest departure was in our civil division. Our civil division handles a lot of employment issues for the various county offices, like the county commission, the sheriff, the auditor, Jobs and Family Services, Metropolitan Sewer District. We also handle contracts like the one for the Bengals Stadium.
Outside of our window, mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, development contracts that the commission wants to sign. So we lost mostly in our civil division in litigators. So that's the biggest challenge. We lost quite a few, and I brought in, back to civil litigation. I brought in a new chief, Steve Simon, who's very, very smart. I knew him in law school, top student, great community participant in his area, his neighborhood of Pleasant Ridge. So he's got great leadership skills too. And I brought in one of my prosecutors from the municipal division, offered to transfer over to civil litigation. And we brought in another person. We're interviewing more. We got three more interviews this month for people to fill those places. But the other area that had the biggest hole was the appellate division. And they handled the criminal appeals. And they lost almost half their staff. They only have nine. We only have nine lawyers there, and they lost four.
Do you think that is? Because to me, that seems like that's just the daily business and not political at all. Like, that's the kind of bread and butter of a prosecutor's office, not like the top spots. Like, what do you think was driving that?
Well, the outgoing chief was getting ready to retire. And he had been hemming and hawing over when, and decided, I'll just do it at the end of the year. And then when I met with him last month, he offered to stay on part-time to help with the transition. So he's staying on. But then the other people who left appellate, I just don't know who they are. I'm not familiar with them. And some of the people in civil, the chief left and her number two. But
we're 5 days into this.
Yeah.
I don't expect you to know every single nitty gritty detail off the top of your head.
But we now have, were you in that meeting today, Jacob? Okay. So we now have, I think we're going to have five openings in the criminal division soon. And part of that is because two of those criminal lawyers moved into, one's going into what they call family law, but which is really children's services, and one's going, it has moved to the civil division already. So we're going to have some openings there. And of course, the chairman of the Republican Party didn't come back, so...
So we aren't asking really a question, though, because we've already reported on, of course, some people are leaving. Mm-hmm. Is the list long, though? Because it does seem like it's to replace people. No, a lot of people want to come work in the prosecutor's office, right?
Oh, yeah. It's an incredibly fulfilling place to work. And you get to really learn a lot. You get to hone your trial skills. You get to serve the community. And frankly, there's a good work-life balance in there as well, unless you're in trial, and every day you're in trial is a 30-hour day.
That's true.
How did the transition go in terms of your predecessor, Melissa Powers? Did you guys sit down? Did you get briefed? Or did she just throw you the keys and say good luck?
No, it was a little bit of both of those. Okay. We sat down. She offered to sit down with me, and we talked over coffee one morning. She gave me a little bit of an overview, but what she did do is enable her staff to cooperate with me. And so the first assistant prosecutor, they're all assistant prosecutors, mm-hmm. but there's a first assistant. Yes. And that's Mark Pietmeyer, who's been at the prosecutor's office about 106 years mm-hmm. and he's a great trial lawyer. He's got... very vast institutional knowledge, at least on the criminal side. And he's the person who goes out to respond to critical incidents with the Cincinnati Police Department or the Sheriff's Department, anywhere in the county, of course. So largely officer-involved shootings. And he's we have yet to train his replacement, so he's going to still do that for us until he retires at
the
end of April.
Who is his replacement?
Well, my first assistant is Heidi Rosales, mm-hmm. and she will be doing some of those, but I'm going to need more than one because I don't think it's fair to anyone to never go on vacation or go visit your parents wherever they live yeah. and you know, have to be able to have to respond. You have to have some backups in place. But Mark's been pretty great. He and I met today, maybe it was this morning, yeah, talking about how we're going to shuffle people around. How being a little shorthanded, how that impacts our ability to deliver. And he's pretty comfortable and confident that this is going to be like when someone goes on maternity leave or someone goes on vacation. We have backups in place, and it'll just be a little bit more of that for a few months until we can fill all these empty positions. But to the gist of it, no, it's not an emergency. We're doing our job. We have some really tough cases in our civil department, and that's why we need to fill those positions first.
I have to say, because I have covered courts a long time ago, and it is kind of funny because some of the people retiring are like the people when I came 22 years ago, like they already were like felony prosecutors, and I was like, they're retiring, and I'm like, oh. They were there when I got there 22 years ago, so I guess if they are thinking about retirement, not that I am, but I never really felt like when I was covering courts, the political aspect of things. Like when you're in the courthouse, you really are about what's happening, whether it's a civil case or a criminal case. You don't feel the politics of it inside when you're dealing with the different cases. At the top, you do, and when we're covering it sometime with races and everything, you feel the politics. But in the moment, it really is about the work, and the people are passionate about. When if you're a prosecutor or a public defender, that's the work you're passionate about because you're not getting paid gobs of money, and there's plenty of law firms in the city where you can get paid gobs of money, mm-hmm. but this is not it.
Right. And I haven't met everyone yet, but I've been trying to start to meet as many as I can. And so far, I'm very impressed with the team that's there. And I do have a sense of their dedication and commitment to the office.
We did see some people jump over from the city prosecutor's office, where we really do see some of the Democrats, yeah. and they wanted to move over to where they could do felony cases and maybe take a bigger role in shaping what the criminal justice system looks like. Can you see a time now that the county prosecutor's office is controlled by a Democrat and the city very Democrat, that the prosecutor's offices do combine into one?
You know, I was warned that this question would come up.
Here you go.
And
I have to say, a lot of people have asked me this.
Because consolidation is such an intriguing
this
topic.
This is like the share. If somebody says the word shared,
half of our listeners are services. Like leaning forward now, like, yes. And the others are like, oh, my eyes are glazing uh-huh. over. But here we
this
go.
This is always yeah. like the top thing. When people talk about shared services, this always comes up.
Yeah. You know, during the campaign, someone advised me that this topic would come up. And it might be my number one, Heidi, who suggested that to be on the lookout for this. But, you know, of all the things on my list of things to do, this is not even a glimmer in my eye. I mean, it's not even on the list yet. But there are a lot of other things we got to do first.
Again, 5 days in.
5 days.
Yeah.
Well, what's the short list then?
Oh, gosh, the short list. So probably the shortest of the short list is to make sure we get our staffing up to levels that I think are better for the long term. And number two is to start the training program. And we do have some super people in that office. I did just extend an offer to hire Kip Guinan as my chief of criminal. And he wants to do a lot of training as well. And I know there's some of these dedicated existing prosecutors who are good trial attorneys, they can do that too. And so training's got to be number one because, you know, the way they move people around, which is kind of common for all of these county prosecutors' offices, to start your new hires in municipal and then move over to juvenile and then move up to felony. But everything's a little bit different in each one. And if you go into juvenile court, you don't have any juries. You don't know the first thing about picking a jury. And the magistrates are helpful to you, but you have to be able to know the rules of evidence, and you have to be able to know how to get a piece of evidence admitted. And not everybody learns that. If they don't have any jury trials in municipal court, which sometimes they do, but they might not have had that opportunity to develop those skills. So we need to make sure that they have these skills. They're critical trial skills that they have to have. And of course, we can use our training program to touch base on any kind of pertinent topic. So for instance, the lawyers in juvenile court should have some training in adolescent mental development and teenage brains and things like that. I mean, that's who their defendants are. They need to know what's going on in there.
Let's get back now to your path to the prosecutor's office. You mentioned your military background, and mm-hmm. you talked about that during the campaign. Let's start with that. What was what was your motivation for your portion of your life where you had a military career?
Well, two main things. I wanted an education, and I liked the idea of wearing the uniform of my country. And where I grew up by Lake Erie, right next to the steel mill, and probably the dad of every kid in my school worked at the steel mill, and when I was in high school, they all lost their jobs. So there was nothing available to us. So I knew I needed to get out of Dodge, get an education. My parents wanted all of us to go to college. They even had a little chart saying which years we would be in. In today's world, we'd call it a spreadsheet, but they didn't have those back then. We did have calculators. That was exciting. And mine did a square root. That was very fun. Yeah.
So this was kind of like a Gantt chart. They wanted to know like the overlap, like who was going to be in school at what time.
Well, and this is what was expected of us. Right. We were going to go to college. And there are five of us, and I'm the fifth. So there's certainly no money for kid number one, let alone kid number five. So we had to find our way. And so when my sister was home from college, I have three sisters, and the one I'm closest to was home from, like, on spring break or something. We were watching TV, and an Army ROTC commercial came on, and she said, oh, you should try that, Connie. You'd be good at that. So I applied for Army, Navy, Air Force. Never heard from the Army. I was a finalist for the Navy and the Air Force and had to go do some interviews. And so my interview for the Navy was in downtown Buffalo. And, of course, it snowed 2 feet the night before. And my sister and I had to shovel the driveway and all that stuff to get downtown. And these two really old guys, they must have been 30 years old. You know, they seemed really old to a 17-year-old. And I don't remember anything about the interview except this one question was, don't you think there would be social problems if women were allowed to serve on ships? And I, being a brilliant 17-year-old, said, well, what do you mean, VD? I didn't get a scholarship from them. But then the Air Force was, again, it was a snowy drive to Syracuse, University of Syracuse, where we had to go in for an interview and had to take a test. And of course, at the end of the basic part of the test, they said, okay, girls, you can all leave. And any boys who want to take the pilot test, you stay. That's how it was. But again, if the throughway was closed. There were trucks jackknifed everywhere. My mom and I went. Anyway, so it was time to get out of there, and that led me to going into the Air Force.
So you're still talking ROTC? You were trying to get the ROTC pro.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
So you started in school as a in the ROTC program for Air Force.
And you went to
Oklahoma.
Oklahoma, that's right.
My dad had gone there during the war. I don't know why, but he did. And his second year, he brought five of his buddies with him, and so. My brother went there and I went there.
So, and how long were you active duty after you graduated?
It was something like 8 years and 4 months. I don't remember the exact number.
So beyond the obligation from
I had a 4-year commitment.
Okay.
And I loved it.
So you must have liked it.
I loved it. I was ready to stay. I got a regular commission about 2 years into my service and loved it. But the Air Force sent me here. To be a recruiter at UC. And 2 days after I moved into my apartment in Clifton, I went out for a run and ran into the Clifton Track Club and met my husband.
And the rest is history.
Yeah.
And stayed here.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm remembering when we were talking to you during the campaign, there was also an event that I think shaped your decision to get into law enforcement.
Yeah.
Especially from a victim's advocacy standpoint. You had a brush with crime yourself when you were in Clifton, right?
Yeah, I was coming out of, this was shortly after we were married. We'd been married maybe 4 or 5 months. And I was coming out of the women's meeting at church and got mugged. Guy dragged me down the street and because I wasn't going to let go of my purse.
You know, they tell you let go of your purse, right? But you held on to it.
For some reason, he managed to wrestle it away, but it was pretty terrifying. And my friends called the police. They called my husband. The police came. They were really good. They drove my car home for me. And it was that incident that I realized I got to do something to make things safer for women and girls. And of course, if you make things safer for women and girls, you make it safer for men and boys too. And so that was the first inkling. But I think I've already shared this publicly. I had a miscarriage after I got mugged, and that was pretty hard too. But I was lucky. I was able to have children and started law school. Oh, about the time I got pregnant with my second. Yeah.
So pregnant in law school?
Yeah.
That is very difficult.
I thought I was being so smart, but first year of law school is very stressful. I don't think anybody sleeps for the first 6 weeks because you're so excited. And
remind us, where did you go to law school?
UC.
That's what I thought. Yeah. So you're a Bearcat.
I'm a Bearcat.
So is Burl.
There's a lot of us around here.
Yeah.
We either don't leave or we end up coming back, right? That's the
It's a boomerang
story.
City. Yep, it really is. It's such a beautiful city.
Well, now that you have, a whole 5 days under your belt, and you've talked a little about the priorities, your predecessor during the campaign, one of her, how she tried to distinguish herself from you was her vast experience versus, in her description of you, someone who's never prosecuted a case. What do you think is going to be your biggest learning curve to get over, and how are you approaching it?
There are a number of things that I have to come up to speed on. And as you know, I think I have the exact right experience for this job, because this is a leadership job, and I got the best leadership training in the world as an officer in the Air Force, and got my MBA while I was on active duty, which I've been using quite a bit this first week to look at the budgets.
Back to spreadsheets.
Back to spreadsheets. Yeah. Figuring out personnel. Things, that's all business stuff.
Right.
And certainly my criminal law background has been extremely useful. Some of the terms that we don't always, they just come out because you remember them, right? You know, like a writ of procedendo or a habeas corpus and all those things. So I want to make sure the listeners do know I do have criminal law background. I was a public defender handling felonies. And I was also a civil litigator. I prosecuted cases in the civil court. You can prosecute a criminal case, you can prosecute a civil case. One could give you jail time. The other one is for money, usually, or an action. So I think probably for me is getting to know the intricacies of the children's services area, because I never did do that kind of work. I have a smidgen of experience in juvenile court, but things have changed, and we have all kinds of different laws now. I think on a different note, I'm finding that a lot of my time is going to be taken up outside the office, going to meetings and interacting with people in the business community, interacting with the various law enforcement agencies across the county. Last week, I went to the Police Chiefs Association meeting up at the new building. It's new to me. I hadn't been there before. And understanding the vast reach that the prosecutor's office has in helping all of these agencies work together, I think that's going to be the biggest learning curve for me. I can do the legal stuff. I've done it before, but it's the network and the influence.
That whole system.
So there's 48 governmental jurisdictions in Hamilton County, because she and I were talking when she was walking in about getting to know everyone in the prosecutor's office, which is a lot of people. It's how I feel like at City Hall, there's a lot of people there working in that government or the prosecutor's office. But I didn't even think about the idea of these 48 jurisdictions, all the police departments and the mayors and all of the people that the prosecutor's office does touch. That is a lot.
Yeah, it is. We're a big county, and there's a lot going on.
Anyone who's campaigned in it will tell you it's a gigantic, the driving across the county. I mean, you could drive more than an hour to get somewhere in this county.
Do you, were there people that reached out to you after you were elected that you were surprised reached out in terms of, oh, I didn't know that person was going to reach out, when you talk about the various chiefs and department heads and things like that?
Not terribly, just because I know that the relationship between the office and law enforcement, the police departments on the ground, has to be very close. And it's been nice to start to get to know some of them. I met with last month, I met with the chief of police in Evendale, Delhi Township, and Sycamore Township. I think it was Sycamore. And they are apparently on the board of the Hamilton County Police Chiefs Association. And they wanted to see who I was, because all they knew about me was what they saw on TV and not things that I put on TV.
Right. Do you think you have a little bit of a PR challenge in terms of maybe people thinking like, well, according to what I heard during the campaign, and, you know, just how people broadly paint Democrats anyway when it comes to, you know, law enforcement and prosecutors and things like that, you know, comparing Democrat-run cities like San Francisco and Chicago, you know, crime, rampant crime and things like that. But this is a kind of a different Hamilton County Democrats, I would say, are different than Chicago Democrats and San Francisco Democrats. But there's still that sort of kind of labeling that people throw out there, soft on crime. Do you think that is fair? And do you think you will be spending time trying to alleviate those concerns?
Well, I suppose I do need to alleviate those concerns, but it's not going to be something I can snap my fingers on and change people's minds. They're just going to have to see what goes on, see how I handle things in this county. And for everyone here, I intend to do this job with integrity and with purpose and with the utmost care for people's safety. I'll just say that out loud right now so everybody can hear. And I understand that politics doesn't always tell the whole story about a person, but people have to find out who I am. I'll do my best to tell them, and they'll have to judge me by how I act.
Which is true. Like, you can't. That's every politician. They can say anything on the campaign trail, but until we really get to know them and see how they are leaders in their various roles, you don't know.
And one of the things that I'm excited about doing is getting outside of the office to participate in partnerships in the community. So we all know about the juvenile crime that spiked and that was caught on video down in Government Square. And then I think it was either the CRBC or 3CDC that financed a grant with the Urban League to put some men on Government Square during the hours of like 2 and 8, which is when the kids were getting off the school buses and congregating. And when teenagers are in mass together, it doesn't matter if they're from a good school or bad school. They're teenagers and stuff can happen. And they have had a superb impact on diffusing crime in that location during the hours that they're there. So I'm hoping that we can find ways to keep that going. And back to you, Beryl, about one of the people that reached out to me was John Barrett. And I did call him. And
a favorite podcast guest of ours.
Yes.
Well, what did he say? Because he could say anything, because that's how John is. What did he want?
Well, I called him left him a message offering to stop by and introduce myself, because he doesn't know me. And he only knows what he saw on TV or what the Republican circles say. And so I thought it was fabulous of him to give me a call back. I went down to his office and got to learn a lot about the history of the company and his personal history and how he came back to Cincinnati and some of the things he'd like to see happen. He also told me he would set up a meeting for me with the CBC, Cincinnati Business Committee. And he was very interested.
That's an important meeting because, as I have often said, because I can get away with it, you know, we have our city of Cincinnati City Council, we have the Hamilton County Commission, but they're a very influential entity as well. They're not elected, but they wield a lot of power because of their position in the community. And like it or not, they need to be factored in because they will totally, you know, they like they have a lot of influence. So,
we're talking about the Cincinnati Business Committee, yes. And it is our business leaders, and they do very much care about what's going on in the city because they have to recruit talent. And in fact, they, 3CDC kind of came to fruition through that group and the actual city because they were worried about what was going to happen to our corporations here. They were worried about crime, of course, but it also was a bigger concern about what does this look like for our city and bringing in the best people.
And John strikes me as a man with vision. And we talked about visions for the renaissance of OTR and for Fort Washington Way. And I mean, just things that he's been involved in and has thought of well ahead of the ordinary citizen would think of. So it was really a fun conversation with him.
It's always fun when he comes to visit us. So I can only imagine he comes with a bullet list of things.
We like when he comes because he usually breaks some news too.
And so, he asked me what he could do. And I talked about finding ways to partner with the community to reduce crime. I mean, my job is in the courthouse, but I'd like to find ways to not need the courthouse as much. So let's try to reduce crime. And there are programs that will work, but we got to test them out, see if they work for us.
I will say, we talked about the grant. I know the city of Cincinnati gave $100,000 to help tap down the crime on Government Square and everything. And part of the money is going towards feeding the kids, like after school. Food makes a lot of things better. It's not necessarily like when they're in school and they're hungry, but there's food and it's a distraction and it's a focal point instead of fighting. And so it is a solution outside of paying the money to a police officer to stand there, but it's paying for food. And I did think that was like a really interesting part of the grant when they were talking about, should we give this $100,000 to this at city council? And there are different kind of solutions. And a lot of these things, I will say, covered the county a long time ago too. And that was in 2008 and 2010 in massive government cuts because of the recession and many resources to the juvenile court and the process. The county shrunk by a third when I was covering it in a 4-year period. And so many resources that you're talking about, mental health services for children, were cut because there just wasn't the money to pay for it. Yeah. We had a Republican commission and they were really looking to stay within that budget. And it was like, oh, well, are we cutting like sheriff's patrols? Or are we cutting this kind of programming? And I haven't seen all of that programming come back. Even as things get a little bit more flush, but not to those days. And so anyway, I hear what you're saying about different kinds of solutions.
Well, we should wrap things up.
Okay.
I have a lighthearted question because I'm just curious. When someone wins a hard-fought election, when did it hit you that you had actually won and that you were going to have to do this job?
When did reality set?
Because you're campaigning, you're not thinking about, you know, you win it, you know, you're going to win. You think in the back of your mind, you might not or whatever. And then the returns come in, the celebration party. When did you what was it like when it dawned, not dawned on you, but when you just realized like, oh, I got what I asked for. Now I have to.
I think it hits me every day, except I say, oh, wow, I get to do this job. I mean, it's a real privilege to do it. I think early in November, after we won, we had our first transition team meeting, and the enormity of the transition is what struck me first. Just because we had already heard some people were leaving, and the past administration wanted us to push through and hire everybody before December was over, and I mean that's just too fast. So, but look, I do want to make sure you know I have a fantastic leadership team, and I'm thrilled with the people we're bringing over. Heidi Rosales is my number one. Jacob is handling press and long-term administrative strategy. We've got Steve Simon in civil, Scott Heenan in appellate, Kate Burrows in grand jury. I'm just thrilled. And we're bringing in Kip Guinan next week for criminal. Still working on the children's services and juvenile areas because don't know who wants to be in charge there. But look, these are good, good people. Smart, dedicated, great lawyers.
All right. Well, you're off and running.
All right. Well, Joe Dieters was a frequent guest, and I look forward to you being a frequent guest.
That's right. I don't think he hit three though.
He did hit three.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
So that's the minimum bar.
Well, it's kind of like how many times you've hosted Saturday Night Live. They have the gold, the jacket club. Yeah. We have something similar here. So yes. But in a, you know, busy time for you, thanks for giving us some of that time
with our
listeners. And, we wish you all the best.
Thank you. And Happy New Year still, right?
That's right.
I'm calling it Happy Snow Year.
Happy Snow Year, yeah.
Well, that was a good conversation. I felt a little bit bad because we were putting on the spot, like, as we said, 5 days in. But people are very curious about, like, the direction the prosecutor's office is going to take. And she is right. I have learned this over many, many years. We don't know until we see.
You're right. It's all going to be about, you know, there's this reciprocating relationship between the prosecutor's office and law enforcement. And it's very common for police officers, union leaders, chiefs to air their grievances with the prosecutor's office if they feel that when they're making arrests that these people are put back on the street. So the whole, is she going to be tough on crime? Is she going to be soft on crime? You know, we're going to see. Now, she has a very compelling backstory. She wants to keep people safe. She, you know, she shared a very personal story about herself when she was a victim of crime, military background. I think, you know, my impression in the one or two times that we've had a conversation is that she's very serious about keeping people safe. So, but you're right. One case at a time, we're going to know what the Pillich administration looks like.
All right. So, we don't always do this on this podcast, but I feel like I should say happy birthday.
My birthday's over, Sherry. It was so last week.
You don't believe in birthday months?
No.
I believe in birthday months. Yeah.
I mean, it was less than a week ago. So, but no, thank you. Thank you, Sherry. Another trip around the sun.
Okay. Did you do anything fun?
Well, Lauren asked me, she's like, what do you want to do for your birthday? And I decided that we hadn't been to the precinct for a while, which is one of my favorite places to eat. I like going in there. I like the vibe of the place. It's not as hottie totty as, you know, Ruby Steakhouse. It's a Jeff Ruby restaurant, but it's not as glitzy, glamorous as his, you know, signature steakhouse at Fountain Square. It's more my vibe. You know, it used to, it's called the precinct because it used to be a police precinct office, and it's got that just kind of old Cincinnati vibe to it, and had a great meal.
Okay. What's the biggest difference between the precinct and Jeff Ruby's? Potatoes, Anna.
The precinct
does not have potatoes, Anna, which is my favorite food in all of Cincinnati.
And you know, at the main steakhouse, I don't call the main steakhouse, at Jeff Ruby's downtown, it's the very typical everything a la carte experience.
Yes.
If you go to the precinct, though, it's like it includes the salad and potatoes.
It does.
It's a place for the people, Sherry. Okay. It's a place for the people. Still expensive, though, but definitely a great place to go celebrate.
Good place to celebrate a birthday.
Yes, I like a good steak. I like a good old fashioned. I got a smoked pear old fashioned, which I recommend if anyone has the opportunity. We did not, you know, speaking of the main steakhouse, they have added to the menu at the precinct the purse cake.
And
the Air Jordan shoe cake and mm-hmm. all that. We did not order that.
Okay.
Because, you know.
It's a lot for two people.
It's a lot for two people, right?
That's like a big celebration.
And yeah. And I'm more of an after dinner drink guy than a piece of cake anyway. So yeah, that's what I did for my birthday. Very Cincinnati. Went to the precinct.
Okay.
You could feel that. Yeah, it was.
Did you get any special presents?
I did, and you were involved in this, Sherry. You know, you're leading me to this. So this was actually kind of cute. Lauren reached out to a bunch of friends and colleagues and acquaintances, and she, now I'm going to tell you how old I am. She got 59 people to send a nice little note, and you're in that book.
I am.
You're in that book. So she gave me this book, and it was fun looking at all the random people that, you know, that took a few moments to write me a nice note.
No, it's the best kind of gift. And it really is. That's the kind of gift that really resonates in today's world. Like the personal things and in a world where we kind of buy ourselves a lot of the material things.
No, it was fun.
The memories.
It was very fun that night going through the little book. Yeah. So anyway, thanks for helping round people up, Sherry.
Yeah, happy
it was
birthday.
Fun. Well, thanks. This is hopefully the first of many 59th birthdays.
I agree with that.
Because I'm going to stop
stay
right now.
At 59,
I've had enough.
I do have to say, I had to ask her how old you were going to be because I wouldn't have thought 59. So
I'm old, Sherry. I'm
That's
getting up
not
there.
Old.
I am old. Well, should we wrap this up?
Yes.
All right. Thanks for listening to this week's episode of That's So Cincinnati, a production of the Enquirer and Cincinnati.com.
If you enjoyed the podcast, please give us a rating and share it with a friend who likes all things Cincinnati.
And if you value local journalism, and who doesn't, and haven't subscribed for full digital access to Cincinnati.com, now's a great time. Just go to our website, click on the subscribe button to see a special offer just for you.
Thanks again. See you next week.